Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to call the ADA board meeting for December 3rd. It's 5 after 1 to order. Corinne, would you do a roll call for the board members, please?
Mr. Wilkins.
Here.
Deputy Commissioner Paradis.
Here.
Mr. Kennedy.
Here.
Ms. Brown.
Here.
Deputy Commissioner Burnett.
Here.
Mr. Dick.
Here.
Mr. Pruitt.
Here.
You have a quorum.
Would you continue with staff and public for roll call?
Since there are a lot of people in this room, I'm going to point to you. Please state your name and your organization. We'll start in the far corner there.
Director Kennedy. Amber A. McGimble,
Chief
of Duty. Brent Appleby,
Ada.
Colin Bailey. Roman
Bailey. Carson
Rosvick, Ada.
Lisa Ross, Detroit Vintner, Trillo.
Jim Hedstaff, Ada.
Mark Gardner, Western Financial Group.
John Springsteen, Ada.
Zach Rowe.
Tim Gallagher, HDR Consulting.
Ellen Grammer, Alaska General Trailer.
Tom Rexon, Ada.
James Wilson, Matthew Burroughs.
Mike Tetsy, Ada.
Jerry Peterson, Ada.
Burrow.
Corey Borgeson, Colored Eye Electric Association.
Ryan Director, Carson Ball.
Tim Jerio, Ada.
Lloyd LeCobbins, Ada.
Bring him in, Ada. Do we have any public on the phone? Who was that, sir? Any other public on the phone?
Thank you, Corinne. Item number four before us is an agenda for approval. John, I understand you have an addition.
Yeah, I have one requested change to add to the executive session. Additional topic is attorney-client communications regarding the Amber Mining District Industrial Access Project.
Okay. Any objection to adding that to under new business D? All right, we'll go ahead and add that. And any objection to the agenda as presented now? All right, we'll approve that. Prior minutes for September 24th and October 22nd.
Item 5. Mr. Chairman, I would move that the board approve September 24th, 2015.
Second. Okay. Any additions, deletions, objections, clarifications? Hearing none, those minutes are adopted.
I'll abstain. I wasn't here.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I would move that the board approve minutes of October 22nd, 2015.
Second. Thank you. Any clarifications, changes, additions, corrections? Hearing none, those minutes are approved, are adopted.
Yeah, Dan will abstain. I wasn't here.
Directly show that to me.
Thank you.
Next up on our agenda is public comments. Again, I'll remind everybody that as previously, please limit it to 3 minutes, and state your name, subject matter, affiliation, if you have one. I will start with folks online. Anybody online wishing to make a public comment to the ADA board?
Mr. Chair, Barrett Pierce, Fairbanks.
Go ahead. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everybody. I hope you can hear me okay. My name is Pierce, P-E-I-R-C-E. I'd like to talk with you about the Interior Energy Project. I start by saying that Fairbanks really needs a home run with this project. But this project is currently contemplated. And I'll extend the baseball metaphor a little bit, the strikeout at the plate. Gary, Dana, you sat through the presentation at Pioneer Park a month ago up here at Fairbanks with the finalists. Everything I saw shows the gas from this project would be more expensive. I said it one more time, the gas would be more expensive than all the other fuel sources. That is, more expensive than fuel oil, more expensive than firewood, more expensive than wood pellets. And we can reach that conclusion by working past some of the confusion that I saw about the difference between the meter price and the burner tip price. I found it alarming that two of the finalists did not appear to comprehend this important distinction. And I'll explain very quickly that the meter price is the city gate price plus the distribution cost. But the burner tip price is what the consumers really pay. It's the city gate distribution plus the advertised cost of conversion. And this project, with all the costs of conversions factored in, results in a price for most consumers at over $20 per million BTUs, making it, again, more expensive than all the other fuel sources. And so, you know, just to keep this simple on a BTU equivalence basis, fuel oil is about $15. Wood pellets are somewhere in the range of $16 to $17. Firewood is anywhere from $3 for those who self-harvest to $12.50 for a quarter of wood delivered. It's absolutely not realistic that there's going to be a 72% conversion rate in this community at current energy prices. People in Fairbanks are not going to convert to gas just to pay more for energy. Broadly speaking, to get the cost down and for this project to really have a chance, there's three areas of concern. Supply cost has to come down. Distribution has to come down in cost, and then maybe with a reduced distribution area for grants. And conversion costs would have to be subsidized. That means going back to the legislature, maybe the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation or some charitable entity that can help subsidize the conversion. And say also a pressing concern is the air quality problem we have. If the project's not poised, it does not fix the air quality problem. It is making people sick and contributing to premature death of Fairbanks residents. I'll reiterate that I've done some very preliminary modeling that shows that this community needs to replace somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000 wood stoves. And they have to go from wood to gas for the air quality of Fairbanks to comply with the National Air Quality Standards for particulate pollution. So the broad question is, how does this happen when the IEP gas is substantially more expensive than firewood? And I'll point out, kind of wrap up here, the commodity prices are subject to fluctuation. The IEP is so rigid in approach that it cannot succeed when commodity prices fluctuate. And just a quick example to prove the point, the Interior Gas Utility reported to the RCA 24 months ago that this project would save consumers 4% if fuel oil prices were $4.82 per gallon. Today, fuel oils are around $2 per gallon. So the projected savings are just fiction. IGU needs a business plan that not only addresses how a voluntary 72% conversion rate can be achieved, but also models the dynamic market forces that will remain in play. And quickly, I just talked with the IGU board last month, listened to them. They don't have such a business plan. And so that's a concern. I know that's not something AIDI can fix. It's something IGU's going to have to work on. But in closing, I've paid a lot of attention to this project for many years, and desperately wanted to succeed. For that to happen, the board is going to have to make a course correction. And my last concern is that if we develop a large standard gas line, Fairbanks is going to need a viable gas distribution system so this community can effectively engage in binding take-or-pay contracts for gas from that project. In the worst-case scenario, is a large line that's built, Fairbanks isn't ready. And we have a large line that comes through or near the community, and Fairbanks isn't able to take advantage of that gas. So, I think I'm probably in my 3 minutes. I thank you all very much for your time.
Well, thank you, Mr. Pierce. The board members, Gary?
Mr. Pierce, thank you for your interest, continued interest. I don't think that the things that you've said to us, with the exception of our two new board members, I don't think you said anything new. So we're aware of all those things that you said. I would suggest you do a little more work on your conversion issues that are being talked about, and in order to lower the conversion price. We are very much aware that this project is driven by demand and early demand. So we're doing all we can to kickstart not only the project but the demand. If you have some suggestions on your 3 points on how to proceed, you've got my email address, you certainly have the board. Feel free to put those in writing and so that we can work on those. We're not going to give up on this project, but we all know it is challenged. And we know we have assets to address exactly what you're speaking of. And we're right in the middle of doing that. So, again, thank you for your interest, and I look forward to your suggestions.
Thank you, Gary.
Well, Gary, thank you very much, and I will do that. And just as a way of responding, I know that one of the challenges that was issued by some in the legislature, I think Representative Walker was one of them, to tell us what we need, tell us what you need to succeed. And I'd rather put the onus on them by making sure that you have a credible plan that addresses all of these questions. And I'll certainly contribute that to you, Gary. I think put the onus on the legislature to make sure this thing is properly funded so it can actually succeed.
Any questions from Juno?
No questions. Thank you, Dan.
All right. Thank you, Russell. Anybody else online wishing to testify? Comment? Anybody else? Hearing none? All right. In the conference room here. Corey?
Yeah.
Welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Cruz. Thanks, everyone. I'm Corey Borgeson, President and CEO of Golden Valley Electric Association. And
welcome.
I'm a little more optimistic than your former commenter. I want to thank the ADA team and what they're doing. I want to commit Golden Valley's help and effort to make this project successful. I want to come back and reaffirm that. We have staff working with Kirk Warren tomorrow on the trucking and regas storage work. I got a meeting with Bob Shapchuk tomorrow in Fairbanks on this. We're committed to doing everything we can to help this project succeed, and I think it's got a chance and opportunity, and I know that we've got great people working on this, so I want to thank you for that. I also want to remind you that the BP gas contract that we've secured is available for this project. It's fully committed. It's and you know, you've got the sole discretion about whether it's a Cook Inlet project or a North Slope, but if it's North Slope, that gas contract is available for the project.
I believe that's an integral part of the decision, you know, looking at North Slope option for you. I mean, thank goodness there's a contract up there to be able to use.
I understand. It's, and my job is 15-year gas supply, maybe could be extended to 20, and I can't say much more than that because of our confidentiality requirements, but we're working through that. And anyway, we're committed to it, and we want to thank you. I know ADA has invested now what I think is close to $100 million into this project with pipe in the ground and the acquisition of a gas utility. We all want this to work, and I know you guys do. So thank you very much for all that.
Thank you. Corey? Gary?
Thanks for being here today, Corey. Short and sweet. We need your 2B, so let's get going.
Yeah.
And it's coming down to the wire, and people need to talk and make some decisions.
And, you know, we've discussed with your team that if the price was as low as $8 an MCF, where we thought the spectrum was, we would do 2B. If it's at $10 an MCF, we're closer to what we call the summer gas, which is 0.6B, which we thought and calculated that kind of really works for this project some, because it helps levelize off the plants. And if it gets up into the 12B range with prices as they are right now, it would be hard for us to use much of the gas at all. But you know, one thing I've always said to this board is that you've got to have a long range look at this project. And we're modeling it over 10 to 20 years and looking at it, and LNG makes sense. So we'll be as we see what the price comes out, how much gas we can take. But as I'm standing from myself as management and the board, our fuel supply needs to be a prudent cost for the utility, and recognizing the importance of the community, of course.
So, Corey, you've been involved in the gas thing with BP for certainly when you're their attorney and now as their...
Golden Valley, you mean?
Yeah, Golden Valley. And so tell me, is it possible that we would ask BP, or somehow in some sort of contract, that we have a lesser rate for the first 10 years and pay it back over the next 10 years? We lower the cost, put it essentially in a accounts payable.
Can you ask them for that?
Yeah. I just wondered.
I mean, what, do we lost the have them pay us to take the gas? You know, you know, from a utility person, that doesn't make sense. That's putting the burden on future ratepayers, and it's always cost causer, cost payer, and mentality. So it's a really different look. You know, and I would, my guidance on that would be is if you want to subsidize something, it would be subsidize the changeover. If I give everyone $8,000 to convert, $10,000, $12,000 to convert, make it that way, and they pay the real cost of the service. You know, I have a different feeling about the conversions, and it's personal, but it's like, you know, I'll pay a little bit more for natural gas. It's cleaner. I want to get rid of that fuel tank that is in my yard that is an environmental hazard. I'm ready to not worry about whether I get oil delivered. I'll pay more for that, and I think there's some people that will do that. I think you'll see a good interest in this fuel.
Anything from Juno? I just like to say thank you too, and Golden Valley, you are a very important integral part of the success of the project up there. And any contributions or guidance is well appreciated. We want to make this work. And we know where the goal line is, and there may be a speed bump or two that we all have to go over, but we're going to get there.
Well, thank you very much. We appreciate being part of the team. We feel like a team player here, even though there's always some tensions there. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, Clark.
Thanks, Clark.
Anybody else in the conference room? All right. Seeing none, I'll close public comments. It brings us up to new business, and number item A, our financial statements presentation.
Item 7A is a presentation of Ada's fiscal year 2015 financial statements. Ada's financial audit occurs every year and results in these financial statements. And at this time, I would ask Chief Financial Officer Michael Lamb and KPMG partner representative Beth Stewart to report on the financial statements and be available to answer questions.
Thank you, John. Mr. Chair, Board. As with AEA, this is a report really to the governing body by the auditors on what I think is fine work by the data finance staff. And so with that, we'll let Beth give a report, and then we'll attempt to address any questions you may have.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Lamb, it appears that we don't have these documents. I have them for AEA, but I don't have them for ADA.
They just arrived.
They just arrived this morning, Fred.
Were there drafts included in the board packet?
I found an email yesterday.
We sent.
Yeah, there's email yesterday.
We sent drafts out probably a couple of weeks ago, with the caveat they were subject to the GASB 68 audit being finalized, which actually happened.
Monday?
It got issued last night. So,
there's been no substantive changes since the draft that was distributed. Or since the draft, I can't speak to the distribution.
Fred, do you have the email from last week or last night?
I found it from
Sherry, right? It was sent by Sherry.
The week before Thanksgiving?
The week before Thanksgiving.
I have it from November 2nd. And it says that the hard copy will be in the board packet. So are these substantially the same?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, I'll
get
these printed for us. Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you. So the documents that you have today and the documents that were distributed earlier in draft form are substantially the same. Those initial drafts didn't contain the signature in one of the final document, but there's no changes of substance either to the numbers or to the content within either of those reports. So there's that significant change other than the reports were issued. So our report, our letter to the board is dated December 1st, which is Monday, and you might realize that that's quite a bit later than the typical timeline for issuance. Typically, we issue our audit report around the third week of October. This year, our timeline was quite a bit delayed because of, as Michael mentioned, this GASB 68 standard. And what that is a new accounting requirement that ADA had to implement in their financial statements this year, relating to recognizing pensions, future pension liabilities for ADA employees. This has been a liability off the books of ADA for until this year. So this is the first year it's coming onto ADA's books. The issuance of the audit depended on the issuance of some audit reports of the PERS, the state PERS system, and those were issued Monday. And so that's the reason for the timeline, literally Monday of this week. That's the reason for the timeline change this year compared to years in the past. But in the letter to the board, we'll talk more about that liability. In the letter to the board, similar to for AEA, it describes our responsibilities, emphasizes that we're responsible directly to the board while we work closely with management and certainly receive a high degree of support from management throughout the audit process. Ultimately, we're guided by professional standards and we're responsible directly to you. And the items of significance related to this year's audit are described on page 2 of the letter to the board, and it does describe this accounting standard change of this GASB statement 68 that's called the pension liability accounting.
Have we been getting those kind of things every couple of years, changes?
There have been a fair number of changes over the last few years, and actually some more to come. So we'll talk about that as well.
They're just not happy, or what's going on?
I think that the accounting standards setters would say that they're in the mode of continuous improvement, and just feel like there's more and better ways to report.
Has there ever been a change that had a positive effect on a balance sheet?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head, actually. I think my personal opinion is that the governmental accounting standards are trying to keep up with or become more similar to commercial accounting standards, with the sort of the acknowledgement that there's many components of government that operate as businesses, really, and that residents and constituents have a view of return that they want from their governments, and so the governmental standard setters are sort of issuing standards that make governmental accounting more similar to commercial accounting. So it's catching up, if you will. I don't think it's good standards. So that's the most significant change. Throughout the rest of this letter, we describe and emphasize the most significant estimates within the ADA financial statements being the allowance for loan loss. There are no uncorrected or corrected misstatements in the auditing process, and so really it's a very clean audit and a significant amount of assistance from the commission in that process. And then we can turn to the basic financial statements that you also have. Our audit opinion is on page 11 and 12, 11 through 13 of this document. Again, an unmodified opinion, a clean opinion, meaning that we believe the financial statements are materially correct as they're presented and include all of the necessary disclosures as they're presented here. And the most significant change in these financial statements you'll see on page 14 And about three quarters of the way down the page, there's a line called debt pension liability, $8.6 million. And I want to talk a little bit about where that comes from. So this
is this on page 14?
Correct.
And where?
About three quarters of the way down under the non-current liabilities section.
Okay.
There's a line called net pension liability.
Mm-hmm.
Do
we have that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So ADA employees are state employees and participate. They were eligible. They participate in the state PERS retirement system, which is a defined benefit pension plan, meaning that the amount of benefit that they receive is established by the plan regulations. The way that liability of the plan is estimated and then ultimately brought down to this $8.6 million in ADA's financial statements is first the PERS plan itself estimates the entire pension liability for all participants in the plan. And that's about $12.4 billion of liability, future payouts to come from the PERS system. That's handled by Division of Retirement and Benefits. They own that system. And then you determine the amount of the plan that's funded, meaning investments are sitting there ready to pay out those liabilities. And that funding is about $7.7 billion. So the unfunded amount, or the amount that future liabilities of the plan exceeds the assets that are set aside there, is about $4.7 billion. And again, this is for the PERS system as a whole. There's a lot of estimates that go into that liability assumption. The estimates include people's mortality rates, future earnings increases, investment portfolio income, whether the spouse is deceased before the employee. And there's a lot of estimates. All those estimates are made by actuaries. So again, retirement benefits, Division of Retirement Benefits runs that whole process. So then it comes down to $4.7 billion of liability that then is allocated between the participants in the retirement system. And those participants include the state and the state agency, as well as municipality, city, things like that. So the $4.7 million gets allocated out to the various participants. And all of the participants this year are having to record their portion of the liability on their individual financial statement. So this statement, the statement, isn't impacting just ADA. It's impacting the state as a whole. It's impacting every city and municipality that participates in the plan to get this liability recorded. After it's allocated between city and state, then the state liability was allocated between the various state employers and agencies, so ADA being a portion of that. And then there's statute that says that ADA only has to contribute up to 22% of salary, and the state covers everything else for benefits. And so it was further allocated between the portion that ADA could be responsible for and the portion that the state had to be responsible for to end up with $8.6 million of liability on your financials. So it started with $12 billion and was allocated down. ADA is 0.18% of the state for the retirement system liability.
So there's a separate owned corporation in the state. That's how you pass it to, but the employees are state employees.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So since I'm not an accountant, if we were to put that money into a separate interest-bearing account, would that then turn into that would go, that line go away?
It doesn't, because you're only,
if we fund it.
Well, you can't fund just your employees, because the nature of the plan is a cost sharing plan amongst all employers that participate in the.
But you've identified a number
by ratio.
And which goes to the financial statement. So that's an expense or a cost. To me, there should be a mechanism in order to zero that out. Isn't that typical? If you whether it's additional capital or a specific account set up, interest bearing account.
That's exactly typical. If ADA had issued a bond, say, and you had funding set aside to pay that bond, or you kind of segregated that out, then it would take the liability off of your financial statement. But in this case, because you're allocated a portion of a much bigger whole, you can't control that liability. It's the state would have to fund the entire $4.7 billion of the plan in order to have all the participating employers have an allocation of zero. So you can't. The liability isn't.
So we can't pay for it.
You can't advance funds for it or pay
for set aside funds.
No, there wouldn't be a way to do that.
Could you report the financial statement with that number being at the end?
With a report number, with the number not in the financial statement?
No, it would be in it, but it would be at the bottom where it would be. You'd have your total net position, and then there would be that number with something no one can control at the bottom that shows it.
It shows up on here as a long term debt, first of all, versus the current short. It's out there. The source of repayment actually is salaries. A normal cost rate, past service cost rate, being added to the salary. That's how it gets paid off. And the idea, and there's been a lot of discussion in the past whether or not pension obligation bonds ought to be sold, because it used to be, I don't know what the number is now, but the assumed rate of return on your investment, partially to get to your question, was 8.25%. The Department of Revenue, I think, has always done this astonishingly good job getting rates of return. It would be very hard for ADA to go get the rates of return. If we took that money, carved it out, if we could, which I don't think we could, carve it out and invest it ourselves, we would never get the rate of return the Department of Revenue gets over it. And then every year, that number is going to oscillate up and down. And part of the discussion I had with the board before is, this is only GASB 68, the pension component. There's not the OPEB piece. And then Seth is saying that these numbers are estimates on top of estimates on top of estimates. And it just changes from year to year. And so, yeah, it'd be nice to pay it off. And that was actually how Fairbanks and Northstar Borough initially got involved. And I got involved in it because we were overfunded and there were $2 million in the hole. Then we're $20 million in the hole, then we're $22 million in the hole. Let's go sell bonds, because at that point it was a single agent, multiple employer system. But in 2008, the state made it a consolidated system and said we're all in this together for a lot of historic reasons that we're not going to talk about here. But I don't think that, as a practical matter, given authoritative guidance, there's very much that could be done in terms of displaying it differently and or even paying it down. So we are part of the system as a whole, and that's just...
So next year, what can we expect? We just kind of sit back and wait for the number? Whatever it is? Is there going to be some sort of any plan on what to expect?
It's tough to plan. I wouldn't expect it to change significantly because it's not...
The problem gets to be is that, and one of the problems that got us into the hole that we're in right now is the actuarial assumptions in terms of what we're needed also drove the liability side. The thing that you can hang your hat on more than anything if you took the balance sheet of the pension fund is the assets. You felt pretty good about those, but even those every year are adjusted mark to market generally at 6/30. The rest of it, the liability side, what happened in the past, quite frankly, was completely understated because of health care costs and everything else. And so part of, brought to the board, and one of the reasons that ADA has brought forth under John and to the board is the statutory change to try to get to take this activity out of our operating funds, because we got to say what we think the value of investments are going to be 12 months, well, 6 months from now at 6:30, no one knows, so that affects the balance sheet side of it. Whether they change the amortization period, the actuarial period, whether they change the mortality, I mean, all of that stuff, when they rerun that stuff, can change. And so, and if they in any way say, well, we think it's going to be in this range, I would never, ever say that.
And is this, it, so this 8.5 was not in 2014. There was no, so it wasn't addressed. So yeah. Is this, just real quick, I didn't look. Does this affect the P&L for 2015?
It actually...
reduced the net income?
Yeah, it didn't reduce net income by $8.5 million. The quickest way to see is on page 15. At the bottom, the third line from the bottom, there's a cumulative effect of prior year's adoption, on prior year's of adoption. That's about $8.5 million in June. That's the amount that would have been expensed. That's a cumulative catch-up to get the liability on your books as of the beginning of fiscal 15.
And you wouldn't go back and restate prior years?
Right. So this is sort of that catch-up. You didn't, in the way this accounting standard was applied, you didn't have to restate prior years. You could catch up, do this catch-up without impacting the income statement to get the liability reported.
But if you would have paid this over the years to make it, it would have been a cost.
So there wasn't a restatement of 6/30/14, but there was essentially a number as of 7/1/14, which was $9.287 million. And then a plethora of adjustments, partially because they actually go back to a prior year. So we went from it. If we had stayed completely on track and nothing had changed, we would have a higher liability number if nothing had changed. Mm-hmm. And so because the entry was made as of 7/1, basically day one of fiscal year 15, no prior restatement of 14. If you had gone back one day, then 14 statement would have all of a sudden been had a new number at $9.2, $9.3 million that wasn't there. But the posting date was 7/1. So all the activity really flowed through in fiscal year 15.
But it doesn't affect the income, net income. It's a liability that jumps on the books. There's no
equity section. So you created it. So you credited equity and, sorry, you credited a liability and you debited, you reduced the equity section. So that was the initial journal entry.
A place that you might see is just a couple rows above where we were just referring to. There's a line called increase in net position. That's sort of the equivalent of net income, if you will. And the liability, the picking up of that liability is below the line, we would call it. So the increase in net position, 27,984 for the revolving fund, isn't impacted by this new liability. And you did record expense in your 2015 net income for this pension liability using a different method than you had before, because this statement also required a change in the method that you used to record expense. But it ended up being the same number as you would have recorded the other way. You used to record as expense what you contributed for that year, about $800,000 a year is what had been being contributed. And this year, you didn't record your expense based on what was contributed. Instead, you recorded it based on the actuarial estimates and your allocations and all of those things. But it ended up being about $800,000 anyway. So your increase in net position for the year really wasn't impacted by the adoption of this accounting standard. So that cumulative catch-up and recording the liability impacts the balance sheet. So it's sort of a below-the-line adjustment. That's a different way to look at it.
I don't know if you do that in the private side.
Yeah, the private side does do that with defined benefit plans. And I encourage the board to carefully read note number 9 that I think very adequately discusses everything from the estimates and the assumptions being made, narrowing it down to the liability. It comes right down to our agency.
Mm-hmm. What is probably true is that implementation of GASB 68 to be in compliance with GAAP-based financial statements that auditors can opine on, the financial impact to us is probably de minimis, non-consequential, if you will. And I'm not saying that some millions of dollars doesn't matter, because I think you and I know it does matter to me. But as compared to what this is probably going to do to boroughs and cities in the state and across the United States, this is far better than I had.
I'm wondering about for next year, if it's going to go up, way up. You got what to anticipate. You know, it erodes equity, right? So is it $100 million a year we're underfunded based on what you see? I mean, you've got to have some amount per year that this cumulative came up to. And so what is that number? So that next year when we see, we won't see 8.5, we'll see 9.1, or I mean, what is it?
What's the range of variance?
Yeah, what can we expect? I mean, because in reality, it does go against your balance sheet.
Right, and there's a significant number of estimates, but there's also moving is maybe not the right word, but mechanisms where if there's significant variability, say if the stock market crashes, say you wouldn't take all of that into your liability. In 1 year, you, for lack of a better word, that over a period of time, or if there's big changes in actuarial assumptions, those are allocated over a portion of time. So there's mechanisms that keep the variability under control. But I wouldn't think it could change by 50%, but I think it could change 10%.
Okay.
Pretty easily. So I don't know if that helps.
If you realize that if you take $7.4 billion and all of a sudden there's a 10 or 20% correction in the market at the wrong time, that affects the balance sheets, that affects the asset side, and all of a sudden your gap is bigger. But, you know, if you want something, I would say probably no more than 25%, but boy, I tell you, it could go either way.
Towns just love that, don't they? This big gap.
Well,
no,
certain people
wouldn't
know the exact answers.
I don't know.
All right,
why don't
you do it? Any other notes that you want to talk about?
No other items of real significant changes in the financial statements here, similar to the discussion on EEA, the question was asked what to expect down the road. And there are a couple of things that are coming down the road that will impact AIDA's financial statements. Two things that will be impactful in this next fiscal year. One, of course, is the acquisition of Pentax and incorporating the Pentax activity into the AIDA financial statements. So that will occur. And then there's an accounting standard on pure value of investments that will have an impact on AIDA. That impact's not yet been assessed, and we're working through that. Management starting to work through that, and we'll continue that through the year. And then in 2017, will be another big impact similar to this pension liability impact, in that the post-retirement health benefits that are offered through the PERS system will be brought onto the balance sheet as a liability. Currently, that 8.7 that we've talked about is the pension side only, mm-hmm. not the health retiree health benefits.
What's that estimate? $12.5 billion on the pension. What is it on the health?
I don't have that estimate. Mm-hmm. I don't know, Michael, if you should I just look at your crystal ball? Mm-hmm. I'm
retiring plan.
Okay. I think it'll be at least as large as the pension.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah, I think it'll be close.
Mm-hmm. So that's not 16. That's 17. And
I think the other big change, really, quite frankly, which is exactly what we brought to you, is that when you look at the on page 15, the net increase decrease in fair value of investments, it's almost in the middle of the section up there, 2015 minus 4.9 and a plus 2.014. But again, it's the swing from, you know,
what page are you on, Mike?
I'm sorry, 15.
Okay.
The income statement.
Okay.
You know, there's the other deal, the no real actual operating results, just the change in the value. One year it's higher, next year it's lower, but it flows through. So that's part of, you know, when we talked about, and the board supported taking statutory changes so that the dividend is based upon operating results. But, you know, here's an example, again, that we had talked about. The largest swing that we have in our operations is really related to the fact that they did valuations one day a year, and whatever the valuation is, it flows through. Gatsby 31, Orange County, we can thank them for that. So operationally, pretty stable, quite frankly.
Yeah, it's a $7.3 million swing.
Yeah. And nobody here can do anything
about it. Yeah.
There's nothing to do about it. It's just the posting, and that's part of what we want to fix for the dividend calculation.
Okay. Questions from the board? Questions? Dan?
Yeah, I sure like Schedule 5 on page 58. And I think from private sector people, they're used to seeing net income. To me, that schedule, although unaudited, included in here, I think really helps understand the financial performance of our entity. And I kind of look for the last 4 years where we've gone from dividends paid back to our shareholders. The state of Alaska gone from $29 million to $20 million to $20 million and then down to $11 million. So I don't really like that trend. I would like to see us more at the $29 million dividend back to the state. And then also on that same schedule, it's listed that we've already appropriated a dividend of $17 million. And I missed that somewhere. Did we already make that commitment back to the state of $17 million for 2016?
For 2016. Because that's from 2014. Mm-hmm. So that's 2014's activity. The year gets concluded at 6:30. The audit gets done.
It's deferred.
Deferred, and then you pay an extra. It's a 3-year cycle.
Thank you.
So the short answer is, yeah, that was declared, but that was based upon activity from.
I need to more fully understand that. Maybe that's going to be on the agenda at our next meeting. So anyhow, I like that schedule a lot. That, I think, helps understand the performance.
Yeah, the short of it is that operating activities conclude, audit's done, go to the board, and so you're partway between the fiscal year, and mm-hmm. then you declare for the next fiscal year when you actually write the checks out.
Okay. Questions from Juno?
Okay.
Thank you.
I'd like to take the moment, and you know, Brenda Applegate's here, the controller, and as with the AEA staff up there, they take real personal the quality of the work, and I think, and I remember if it was Gary or you, Daniel, said it, that they don't get to go out and touch and feel and do projects and see them, but I think that they know that the quality of their work and the trust in the doc. People can always disagree about what you did with the money, but the fact you can trust that when you're given something, it's right and it's timely, that's great value. And so I just want them to be acknowledged for that.
Great. Very good. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, can I put on the record that thank Michael and John and our accountants for bringing us a clean audit. It's very comforting to know that. And we've had a history of that, and I'm glad to see that history continues. So thank you for everybody who put all that work in, especially those folks behind the scenes that are grinding it out. Thanks.
Thank you, Gary. Next up is the Pentex rate setting presentation.
So Item 7B, presentation of the rate setting process for Pentex. This time I would ask Dan Britton and Mark Gardner to present, call on others as needed, and also want to note that Lisa Ross is here and is available to answer questions as well.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, as you, those of you who are here recall, the Pentex acquisition was intended as a strategic and short-term investment for ADA with the intent to transfer the utility to local control as quickly as practical. And more recently, the goal for that is June 30th of 2016, which keeps it within the current fiscal year and expedites the ability to get local control on the utility in the Fairbanks North Star Borough and achieve the other goals of the IEP. Part of the process of the ownership, the temporary ownership of Pentex, is that the ADA board becomes the rate setting authority for the FNG gas utility. The gas utility, because it is in public ownership, is not subject to Regulatory Commission of Alaska regulation. But the board established a rate setting process that is similar to what you would do for a regulated utility. And Mr. Britton and the staff at FNG went through the same kind of process that they had before for building a 2016, and this is a calendar year 2016 budget, and the rates, proposed rates for 2016. Because of the timelines in the process, what we're proposing here is that you would have a temporary rate setting process, which would occur at the meeting on the 17th, not today, by the way, and then sometime during the first quarter of 2016, we'd go through the somewhat longer process for public comment to then adopt permanent rates for the calendar year 2016. And again, if we're successful in moving the project along to the point that we have a sale or other transfer of the utility to the local control entity by June 30th, this would be the only time that you would be setting rates for Fairbanks Natural Gas. So that's the context for the presentation that Dan's going to make.
So, correct me wrong, is this Dan's first presentation as part of our team?
It is.
Welcome aboard, Dan.
Thank you. I appreciate it. With that, I guess it's my turn. So, thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to present the 2016 budget to the board. Kind of the overall goals of the budget was to maintain a healthy utility, reduce rates to customers in Fairbanks, identify areas, the key areas of the ADA involvement that reduce costs. And you can see that in the significant reduction in general administrative costs of about $1.2 million. And as Mark said, we're moving into an interim step here because of the public comment process, but the work that's gone into developing the budget and developing these rates is supportive of a permanent rate structure and all the necessary components are there to establish a permanent rate structure as we move forward. We're looking at an overall rate reduction to residential customers, about 13.5%. So the residential customers on a percentage of rate basis would receive the greatest benefit of the ADA involvement, with the commercial customers falling behind that, a small commercial at 12% reduction, large commercial 11.3%, and then our small interruptible just under 2%. It's a challenging year in 2016 for budget purposes for the utility for a couple of reasons. Primarily is the cost of oil. So with the reduction in oil pricing, we have seen a reduction in our volumes, most specifically from our two largest customers in Fairbanks, being the University of Alaska Fairbanks and the Fairbanks Memorial Hospital, which are two large interruptible customers that at this time are using oil versus gas because of the significant cost reduction in oil. So with those volume, if we would have those volumes in a normal year, we could have looked to a further reduction in rates. But because of the challenges right now with the significant drop in all costs. It challenges our
Can you tell me what the university is saving by not going from gas, going to gas, going to oil?
So right now the university is paying, to the best of my knowledge, around $2 a gallon for oil, which is somewhere around $15 an MCF, a gas equivalent. So it would be dependent on the rate we establish for the university on what that cost would be. But in order to get to a scenario where the university was contributing margin above our fixed costs of providing services, or excuse me, up and above our variable cost of providing services, we could get to a rate of maybe $16.50 and still have a positive contribution margin to the utility.
So that $1.50 is equivalent to how many dollars? I mean, just bottom line dollars.
The university will use about 60,000 MCF in a year of gas, so it's somewhere around $100,000 for the university.
But so that $100,000 extra would equivalent to a reduced rate for all the consumers that I call it the residential.
It is. It's not a significant reduction right now because we would have to reduce the contribution margin that the university would be making to the utility by reducing rates to $16.50. You know, to deliver the gas in LNG form to Fairbanks and then revaporize it for somewhere around $15.80. So there is a, you know, maybe about 70 cents an MCF that's being contributed to offset fixed costs of the utility. So it's not a huge number, but it would be a positive contribution to allow for some reduction in the rest of the customer classes. So moving forward, what we would anticipate doing and what is currently allowed in the FMG tariff is to look to establish a rate to those interruptible customers and work to get them back on the system. And then we could look in the future as to any of the positive margins that's done would go to cash, obviously, at the beginning, but that could be decided in the future as to whether that cash can use to offset other rates. But for now, given the unpredictable whether or not they will come back to the system, given the current cost of oil, we have not budgeted any volumes for either of those customers. It's about 16. So the rates are being established without those volumes, or recommended without those volumes. Other than that, the biggest contributors, we are also continuing to see a slight warming trend that you can, in Fairbanks, we've heating degree days have been much lower than they have been in past years. So we've budgeted our heating degree days based on about a 15-year average, previous year 15-year average. So it's lower heating degree days than historical, slightly higher than last year as far as what we're budgeting. And that affects the volumes that the utility will see. We are seeing a cost of gas increase from 2015 to 2016 that was part of our gas contract that we signed with Hillcorp, which was the consent decree pricing. So that contract was signed a couple of years ago and it goes out till May of 2018. So those are automatic price escalators within that contract. So,
and you're not the only utility affected by that?
No. We essentially all have the same pricing right now under those consent decree pricing that were established when Hillcorp purchased assets in Marathon and Chevron.
How much did it go up?
Yeah. About 4%.
4%. And so we have two more years. That will affect us.
Yes.
Is it 4% a year?
Yes. And there's the gas contract, not to get too far into weeds, but it's a two-tier contract. It's got a base cost of gas for our base load, and then there's a swing gas. So in the wintertime when we're purchasing higher volumes of gas, part of it's priced at base, part of it's priced on swing, and it's a formula. So in the winter when we're purchasing those extra volumes, our volumetric gas cost goes up slightly. It's compared to when in the summertime we're purchasing just base gas at a lower cost. So what that is the producer, in this case Hillcorp, the mechanism is, you know, you're paying for that swing service. So because we're not a baseload customer, we're not buying the same volume of gas every day all year long, and we have peaks in the winter time, we're paying for that service to a swing cost of gas.
Would it, just out of curiosity, would it help for the summer gas that Corey was talking about, that 0.4, right now help?
Right now we have excess capacity within the Titan liquefaction facility, and we could, if we were to be able to sell that excess capacity, it would help to reduce the fixed cost of running the Titan facility.
Do we have enough now to cover what he was talking about?
Corey mentioned 0.6. We have about a 0.4 BCF excess capacity in the plant throughout the entire year. The challenge would be meeting the daily needs of Golden Valley with that plant without some form of storage to be able to handle that.
Well, I understand that,
yeah.
But if the storage was there...
If the storage was there, we could produce about another 0.4 BCF from the existing liquefaction asset that's in Cook Inlet. But right now, the range of sales out of that facility, including the peaking for Fairbanks Natural Gas, has been, this year's budget is about 750,000 MCF. It's reached as high as close to 900,000, you know, when we had the market with the hospital and the university. So that plant can handle about 900,000 MCF of volume, taking into consideration the peaking needs in the winter. Its actual annual capacity is about 1.4 BCF. So if you had somewhere for that LNG to go and could just keep the plant running every day.
In the summer.
In the summertime, primarily. Yeah. For the most part, expenses remain pretty consistent with previous years. In your package, you've been provided a five-year comparative. There's a one item in the liquefaction side that you may have noted, this appears to be about a $500,000 increase in expenses on liquefaction expense. What the majority of that is the move of the gas that we use in the liquefaction process from the cost of gas category to liquefaction. So it's not truly a $500,000 change in operating expense. It's a reallocation or move of where those funds are budgeted. And other than that, we're in a cycle in 2016 versus 2015 with the liquefaction operations. In that every other year we have to do major overhauls on our major reciprocating equipment. And then in 2015 we did top end. 2016 we have to do a full end frame. So it increases expenses and it's cyclical. Within the rates and the budget we're proposing, there's approximately $900,000 of return to ADA. And we are maintaining a cash position in the companies, essentially a neutral cash position from the time of the end of 2015 to the end of 2016. So the budget is not meant to build cash. It's maintaining the existing $2 million approximately of cash that's considered a operating reserve or capital reserve and can be identified more specifically in the future if necessary.
Chairman? Yes.
Do you want to take questions as we go through this or wait?
Why don't we try to take them as we go now, Greg? Go ahead.
Okay. I just had a quick question on that cash reserve. So 20% of annual expenditure, so that's about 2.5 months. Is that a utility norm? Is that a little bit light?
I would suggest for this utility it's about normal, perhaps even slightly higher than we normally would maintain as far as cash position.
And then my next question was on the other topic you mentioned, the ROI of approximately $900,000. What is that as on a percentage basis?
Yeah, 2.5.
About 2 or 2.5%, I think.
And I should point out, Deputy Commissioner, that the financial plan for the FNG and the Fentex acquisition actually didn't anticipate recovering return in cash from the 2016 operations, but rather that it would be recapitalized when we financed the sale of the utility to the local control entity. So this is intended to put a buffer in there so that the rates reflect some level of return, but not to recover the full return, which we estimated to be a little over 5%. And if we are successful in making the sale by June 30th, then we'll have owned the utility for about 9 to 10 months. And, you know, we do the return calculation at that point based on that period of ownership. So the revolving fund would get the return for that period of months on the amount of the investment at that point.
So
what follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, I was going to ask. Let me ask this one question. So that you brought up based on the strategy. Is there a danger here by setting rates, and then the local control entity, if we set them wrong, there is a possibility, and when I say wrong, too low, that they would have to then increase them in order to build up at least some cash to be able to run their operations and do capital expenditures?
Mr. Chair, no, because
we set them and we set it over, the next thing we know they're increasing them 10% because there's not enough money for them to operate.
And the leadership of IGU has raised that as an issue.
Okay.
The answer is no if we stick with the plan of finance that we have been using since the Fentex acquisition, which is that, again, that we would capitalize most of Ada's return when we recapitalize the whole utility. And at the same time, by the way, we're wrapping in the loans for pipe for both IGU and FNG. And that whole structure is premised on having as much of the low-cost capital as we can get in. So some of the capital appropriation from the state, some of the sets financing, which is both low cost and can be deferred for a long time, and then the state moral obligation bonds for which Ada has the authority. That package would be used to finance the acquisition of the utility from Ada's revolving fund into the local control entity and all of the other capital requirements of the utilities. And that structure is designed so that the capital requirements for that plan come on deferred 2 years or more with the expectation that during that time we'll have the additional gas supply and we'll have conversions and more demand for gas. If all of that transpires as it's planned, then the rates would actually go down more as that occurred, and then slowly go up after the full capital plan comes into play. But there would not be a short-term rate shock as a result of that.
Brad, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mark, the 2.5% rate of return on investment, the $900,000, that's been set deliberately low with the thought that when we close the deal, hopefully by June 30, we'll finish taking a return out for the revolving fund. What's the target return for the revolving fund? Is it some sort of average of 5%, or is it specific to this project? Who set that target? What are you using as a basis for that anticipated return?
What we're using is the ADA's regulations for return on revolving fund investments, which is a 30-year treasury rate plus a bump on top of that. At the time that the
investment was made, that worked out to something like 5.06%. Today would be 5.4 something, I believe. So it's in that range.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, let me correct myself. I shouldn't have said you. I should have said we.
Them. Okay. Go ahead, Dan.
Within the budget as well, we've got capital expenditures both at Fairbanks Natural Gas and at the Titan liquefaction facility, just under $400,000 for Fairbanks Natural Gas and just under $200,000 for the Titan facility for various projects. I could get into the specifics if you like or ask any questions.
Does it increase production?
There is no production increase with those capital expenditures, unfortunately.
I should note, Mr. Chair, members of the board, though, that we did in the process of the acquisition, Pentex and Ada and Ada's consultants worked together on evaluating the requirements of the system both in Fairbanks and at the plant, and there were significant improvements made, again, not so much for capacity, but to make sure that we had a robust system prior to the closing of the acquisition. So these are additional investments beyond those that were made just in the last few months.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Craig?
Yes. So these are obviously nominal sort of investments, status quo investments. Are they aligned with what was anticipated at the close, or they're just, again, they appear light if you were, I guess what I'm trying to ask is what's the next tranche of needed capital investment? Because this is just kind of keeping your IT systems up and going and doing a little insulation work.
So the utilities and Ada's technical team are meeting tomorrow in Fairbanks to go over the longer-term capital programs for the...
Like a 3 or 5 year...
Yes, sir.
These are essentially status quo operational capital improvements or capital expenditures and not... not growth-related capital expenditures.
Yeah, not debottlenecking or...
They're not.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Just out of curiosity, Dan, to increase the existing facility at all, 10%, 5%, I don't know, is that a possibility?
There is some possibility, I believe, to increase the existing liquefaction facility. We have done a fair amount of that over the years. We are at the next major bottleneck that's within the facilities in the pre-treatment component, the amine CO2 removal. That unit is at its capacity right now, and any enhancements to liquefaction, we first have to deal with that. So we have about a 50,000 gallon per day maximum production capacity at the liquefaction facility, Titan. We may be able to get somewhere to 60 or so with some investments.
That would be 20%?
Yeah.
Just
asking. So there is some potential for a minor modification or for a minor production improvement. At that point, we're fairly maxed out at that facility. I mean,
would that handle Corey's summer?
No.
At 6.6?
The problem with the 0.6 in the summer, not problem, it's just the reality of the 0.6 in the summer, is their daily needs are somewhere around 80,000 gallons per day to meet that requirement. Does that make sound about right, Corey? Yeah. So that you need to have some way to build up that volume to be able to...
No, I understand on the storage side. So,
yeah.
But that's a different story. I'm making sure you have there's an ability to get there with this existing plant in the summertime without storage separate. Is there a way to accomplish the 0.6 that he needs in that would need in the summer?
Potentially.
Okay. I'd be curious.
Ignoring the storage.
I'd be curious at some point to visit about that in general terms.
I think with that, we've touched base on the high-level items of the budget, and leave it to the, any specific questions that you may have.
Well, you want to talk about the what your rate, what your proposed rate changes are, or rate?
Yeah, I thought I did cover that, but I can go over that again. Okay. Maybe I went too quickly. So
percentage-wise, dollars-wise, where is the average? Average resident?
Yeah. So our current residential rate is $23.35 per MCF. We're proposing a 13.5% reduction for a residential customer that takes that down to $20.20. An average residential customer will use somewhere around 150 or slightly below MCF a year. So that's about $3 rate reduction. That's about a $450 savings for an average residential customer.
Per year?
Per year.
Okay.
And you can see on the sheet that we provided, just put in context, we have about 464 residential customers on our system today. Small commercial customers, we have about 615 of those. Current rate is $22.91 per MCF. Proposed rate is $20.16, and that's a reduction of 12%. Our large commercial customers, number of those would be 31. So just to put it in context, what we differentiate to large commercial, small commercial. Small commercial is a warehouse, small restaurant, something like that on our system. A large commercial would be a Home Depot, a Lowe's, a larger hotel, something like that, just to put that in perspective. Proposed, our current rate, $22.66, proposed at $20.10, so 11.3% reduction. Our small volume interruptible customers, that would be primarily schools, some hotels, operations that have the capability and the wherewithal to be able to switch to alternative fuel source when called upon. Their current rate is $20.39, and the proposed is $20.03, so a smaller percentage reduction of 1.8%. We talked about a little bit about the interruptibles, the two large ones being the hospital and the UAF. We currently don't have any volumes budgeted with those. Their 2015 rate for those customers is $19.50. We'll look at potential of rates in the range that we possibly bring them back onto the system. Overall, rate reduction of approximately 10.4% on average.
Mr. Chairman?
Fred?
Yeah, could you speak to us how you allocated the rate reduction between customer class?
Sure. So we haven't completed what you would consider a classic cost of service study as part of this rate setting mechanism. What we did was to recognize, I think the greatest driver behind the state involvement in the projects was to bring benefits to the residential consumers through rate reductions. So we wanted to make sure that the residential consumer saw as significant a reduction as possible. At the same time, maintaining that rate structure whereby the commercial customers, because of their higher volumes, saw lower rates on a volumetric basis than the residential customers. So it was maintaining sort of the current rate structure that F&G has, where the commercial customers pay slightly less as you use more, while still trying to reach as much cost savings to the residential customers as we could.
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
Just follow up. I'm looking for the mathematical logic in the allocation between rate classes. So the residential has decreased by 13.5%, by $1.15, but the it's roughly comparable except for small interruptible. So why is that exception carved out?
The exception is that the small interruptible customers were already receiving a fairly significant cost benefit compared to the firm customers prior to the rate reduction. And so
it evaporates in the reduction.
Right. So they don't see that significant rate reduction.
But isn't the point that they're interruptible, therefore they should see a reduction?
Generally, the point is that the interruptible customer should see a savings versus the firm. Yes.
So, but you wiped out that difference in this recalculation.
We reduced the difference.
Okay, I'm over-describing it, but I'm also close to the truth.
Correct. Yeah, we reduced the difference significantly in this rate reduction. Yeah. And the primary, one of the primary drivers there was to maintain as much rate reduction to the residential customer as we could. And if we were to increase the reduction to the small interruptibles, we'd have to increase the rate to the residentials and other classes to maintain that discount.
Or reduce the return that we're recovering through cash.
I'm just trying to understand the rationale. If the rate structure before, which was as a... Weren't you a regulated entity with RCA rates?
We were a regulated entity with exemption from RCA economic regulation up until the time of purchase. We were in the middle of our first revenue requirement rate cost of service study filing with the commission during that time that was not completed.
I guess as this is our first rate setting exercise with the purchase entity, I don't want to assume that your existing prior rate structure was that the hierarchy that you had in that rate structure was perfect or anything like that. But on the other hand, this is a dramatic change for that small interruptible category. And the rationale for putting more chips on residential, if you will, it seems like that interruptible customer, which you described as schools and hospitals, is not seeing the benefit of the change. And I just want to understand how we're going to explain that.
It's primarily school. The interruptible small commercial is primarily schools and a number of hotels is what most of
them. Excuse me, I wrote down hospitals and you said hotels.
Yeah, the hospital is our large interruptible customer.
Yes. I just wrote the wrong word down.
Right.
But again, what's the rationale for the change in structure? How do we articulate that?
So, you know, the interruptible small commercial customers have, for the most part, been receiving firm service. We have not interrupted a small interruptible customer in our history to date. So when you look at cost of service study, they are receiving a higher level of service than they really were paying for. Yeah. So the percentage reduction because of the ADA purchase, while it not be at the same level of the residential and commercial customers, they still do have a rate incentive to have that alternative fuel. It's just more. They are receiving a high level of interruptible service. As I said, the small interruptibles have not been interrupted in our history. The large interruptibles are interrupted on a regular basis in the winter time.
So let me flip the question to you then, Mr. Chairman, follow up.
Go ahead.
Is the differential now, it's down to 7 cents from large commercial or 13 cents from small commercial. If you were a small interruptible, wouldn't you walk away from the potential for an interruption and just, you mean you're going to go from 2039 to 2016, so are you losing your ability to interrupt?
No, not today, although I think it's a valid comment on being able to attract a new interruptible customer versus a firm customer. So they can't just come to us and say, we want to be a firm customer now because we don't have the capacity to accommodate that. If we did have the capacity to accommodate, they could. The risk we run...
Well, but the way you shifted these rates, why would they knock on your door and ask that question?
They very well might do so. A lot of these interruptible customers maintain the secondary fuel source also at their convenience and make switching for financial decision reasons. So your observations are very valid. It was a bit of a judgment call as it relates to the interruptibles on how to move the costs around, and we could look at, you know, smoothing that out again, but or making it more comparable to the past. But we were focused primarily on trying to drive as much rate reduction to the residential class.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Fred. Gary?
Thank you. Staying on page 21, Dan. A couple of questions. First, did you say in your opening statement, looking at UAF, gas price per MCF, that if at $16.50, they're currently at $15, at equivalent of $15, and at $16.50 you're marginally positive?
Yes.
Okay. Is the $500,000 there equivalent of a demand charge? Is the customer charge the same as the demand charge?
The $500?
Well, it's $500?
Yeah, it's not $500,000. It's just $500.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And that experiment next question. Okay, then if I'm talking to the newspaper and I look at line, your last three lines there, the MCFs are essentially the same between 15 and 16, and the revenue is about a difference of about $1.92 million. So I can say the effect of this rate change saves the 1,100 customers about $2 million a year.
That's correct.
That's what that says, isn't it? Thank you. Back to the timing as far as interim and rates on page 5. So help me understand. So we're going to work on this today, and then it's going to come back to us on the 17th. We're going to vote on it, and that will be essentially an interim rate, which then will go out for public comment to come back to us for a permanent rate. Is that the timing after a 30-day period? Okay.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And the plan had been that the resolution that you would vote on the 17th would make these rates effective January 1, 2016.
And that January 1 date is still valid?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And then the last thing, we talked about all this last summer when we were taking all sorts of heat to make this change. Mm-hmm. And we promised 13.5%, and I'm glad that we were right on. We were delivering what we promised. And I think that's notable. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I think that it is notable given the challenges as it relates to the current market conditions as well as the other stuff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Gary. Further questions from the board? Further questions from Juno?
Thank you.
Welcome aboard, Dan.
Thank you,
Mark.
Thank you.
All right, next up is our Interior Energy Project update.
Item 7C, update on the Interior Energy Project. I'd ask Bob Shepchik to come up and present, and following others is required.
Good afternoon. With me is Gene Terrio. As you probably know, Nick Simoniak is usually with us on these presentations. Because of the time that the meeting has run, he is actually bargaining with one of our two potential finalists, and so I told him that was probably of more value than his time at a board meeting. So he's working away advancing the project while we work on this. Yeah, before you, a memo dated December 3rd, it really outlines where we are with the RFP process and the selection of a private partner to develop the liquefaction component of the project. At the beginning of that, there's a little background that really is just a reminder of the context of why we're here in terms of meeting the goals of the Interior Energy Project, and that this competitive process for the RFP was driven by the intent language in the recently passed legislation of House Bill 105. And so we are both working toward a cost-effective solution and complying with the requirements that we got in the last legislative session. The summary from June 5th to October 22nd, I won't spend a lot of time on that. That really is, you received a briefing in at the end of October on where we were, and you know, essentially we've taken our funnel and gone from the history of good ideas that are out there to 16 proposals in our initial round to 5 finalists, and the 5 finalists each submitted best and final offers October 30th. And so as we're working our way forward, and for the attachments, just for reminders, you have the attachments every time an announcement went out that said where we were in the process that that's available in your packet. So what's current from our last board meeting is we did receive 5 best and final offers from all 5 finalists. Those were immediately, you know, given to an evaluation committee who reviewed them. Those finalists were also asked to come to Fairbanks and make a presentation at a town hall meeting. Some of you were there. And you know, with Fairbanks, you never know on a winter night, are you going to get 20 or 200 when you have a public meeting. And we had 120 people sign in, and that plus staff, presenters, and people who don't sign in. We had probably 150 people in the Pioneer Park Hall, which for a weeknight meeting in Fairbanks in the winter is pretty good presentation to sit through 5 PowerPoints. And so we were happy with the attendance. We were happy with the comments we received. 4 of the 5 finalists presented, and Ada, Senator Wilkin, and myself both presented on behalf of Ada to describe where the project was from our perspective. The evaluation committee met mid-November, and they went through each of the proposals. The process that had been established is every committee member was to independently evaluate their packet of best and final offers, bring in their ranking of first, second, and third, and scores were assigned to that. We did that, and immediately when the scores were put up on the board, 2 of the finalists rose to the top and were very close. We spent the major part of that day then going through a discussion of what was in each proposal, why were they ranked the way they were, to make sure that everybody was using a common base of knowledge and understanding. And at the end of the day, we had the same 2 proposals at the top, very close. And the process we described was that we would work then to consensus on selecting one. To a person around the table, all 8, it was unanimous. Really, we would like more information on these 2 top before we pick between the 2. And so our intent had been to bring you a single proposed partner recommended to go forward at this meeting that you would act on the 17th. As a result of our evaluation process, we provided notice to all 5 finalists. You have a copy of that as well. And Spectrum, LLC, and Salix Inc. were the 2 top-ranked finalists. And Spectrum is proposing a North Slope tolling plant. Salix is proposing a Cook Inlet tolling plant. And we met with both of those the following week and outlined, here are the items at which we're going to review. Commercial and finance terms. Understanding the best and final offers completely. Proposed rate structures to make sure that there's a full understanding of how the rates would come together. And really, finally, the scrubbing of capital and operating expense estimates as they roll into rates and doing third-party verification of those. And that we've got Mr. Simoniak is assigned to one vendor. Mr. Gardner is assigned to the other as the lead person and responsible for clarification. Mr. Warren is doing the OPEX and CAPEX third-party verification, and our target is to have that all pulled together by the 10th of January so that the committee can re-meet mid-January. To some extent, this is work that would have gone on had even one been selected and doubled our workload to make sure we're doing it with two, but to bring you the best project with the best information that you know. The only person that I talked to about, well, we're going to slip our schedule a little bit in order to make a final decision, that was really had a lot of angst about it was me, because I had set the December 3rd and December 17th deadlines and pushed the team hard to get to them. Really, there was no good business reason not to extend and not to make sure we had the best information. And so that's the call the committee made. And so you have two finalists now that we are working with, or the two top-ranked respondents, I guess is how they're identified in the communication. And, we're happy with both of them. They both felt like they'd ended up in a tie race, and neither of them were really happy about continuing the race a little further. But we're working on our side, and they're working on their side to get the information together. When we meet in January, the January 13th meeting, by then we'll have a sense of what's come in. We'll have a sense of the committee's ability to act on it, and we'll talk to you about a special meeting that meets your schedule and the ability to provide public input and comment on a recommendation at that time. I would expect, early February or so, depending on what we've got and board schedules. And so with that concludes my report. Gene, you may want to weigh in a little, because Gene has started sitting in on all the meetings as we look to a transition.
Mr. Chairman, as I transition from my position at AEA to the position with ADA, I have just signed confidentiality agreements, so I can start to participate or listen in on some of the information as the evaluation committee finalizes a recommendation to the board. That would then help me as hopefully the board selects the final winner of that RFP process, and then staff continues to interact with them as the construction of that gas supply is done over the next year and a half. When that's done, Bob is intended to sort of decrease the number of hours that he puts into the project. There'll be a transfer of the IEP lead from him to myself. He's still going to be available as a resource to work on the negotiations for the combination of the two utilities, with the target date set for the middle of next calendar year for that transaction to take place. But then there will be sort of a shift to the contract for the supply is underway. The construction for that supply is underway. Hopefully the combination of the utilities into one takes place. Hopefully we have passage of conversion and assistance legislation that is queued up in June of this year. And so I will continue to work with the either separate utilities or combined utilities and the local government on then utilizing those mechanisms to assist the consumers to convert to natural gas when the supply and the system can all come together. But I took some comfort in the fact that Bob said that he wasn't going to be gone, certainly not before the finalization of the RFP for the supply. And then even then, the depth of knowledge that he has in the negotiation between the utilities for the combination into one utility, it would be very difficult to just replicate all of that. So his willingness to stay involved in those negotiations is very helpful. So. And originally I had thought that my continued involvement would be through a contractual arrangement, but I think with the anticipation that there may be follow-up questions from legislators this year on a report, where are we? We're making quarterly reports, written reports to them, but we may very well be asked to make a presentation to the legislature. In addition, we do have the PACE legislation that was introduced by the administration that's pending in both finance committees. And it would be difficult to represent ADA in the legislative setting from a contractual position. And so the determination was that a temporary position was the preferable way to move forward.
So I want a couple quick things, Bob.
You bet.
Not to read too much into your statement that both both proposers, finalists, are really close. I mean, that's very, very good considering the fact that the last option that we looked at ultimately didn't execute was North Slope because of the cost of the infrastructure up there. So that's, I'm kind of reading in between the lines, that's good news that maybe there's another solution that may be more economically viable up there as an alternative, you know, as not as an alternative, but as a primary source of LNG. And then on the Cook Inlet side, where are we at as far as integrating with FNG, now that we're on FNG, integrating it if something was to happen at Cook Inlet with a third party?
Your first part of your assessment is accurate, that what we have in terms of what's proposed from the North Slope, while the challenges from the North Slope haven't changed in terms of a more expensive operating capital environment and a more difficult supply chain on the haul road, the expectations for cost and unit cost are much more attractive than the project we had before. For the Cook Inlet, we made available through Mr. Gardner, who was acting as the owner's rep on the Titan facility, to all the proposers as we met with them. Keep in mind that we have this facility that is likely to be owned as of the 1st of October or the 15th of October as you put your projects together. And we received interest in that from multiple proposers when the best and final offers came in. So the ability to coordinate either operations or dispatch out of a Titan and Cook Inlet plant is one of the benefits from a South Central approach, and that's being explored with Salix because they're the Cook Inlet one of the top two.
Okay. Would you anticipate an operational savings?
Depending on site location, the operational savings could, if it's a co-managed facility, could be substantial. If they're located 30 or 40 miles apart, then it's unlikely.
Okay. Questions from the board?
I just had a quick interjection. I didn't want Mr. Terrio's news to slip by unremarked. So we get to take back all the nice stuff we said.
Sounds like it. Again. Gary?
In 1 minute, the event in Fairbanks was really well attended. There were 150 seats set up, and all of those were almost all were filled. But there was a big standing room only in the back where people are on the cookie table. So there was easily 150 people. And the feedback that I got was really from the positive side. People were very appreciative of this happening, and they were reminded that this was not a required effort. This was an idea of Bob and FEDCO to do this, to keep people current. And so, and they were surprised. The couple talked to me, they were very surprised about how far this had come since August when they got the last report. And so that on the positive side. On the negative side, there were some folks that weren't happy about not having the ability to do questions and answers. And we had a time frame to put it in, and it would have been almost uncontrollable, I think, to do that. So that call was, there was a lot of information shoved down. Presented in that very short period of time. And to sit and try to compare those four presentations was very difficult. But the message was there that it was moving ahead. There were professionals that were going to do something for us. The other one was, the other question I got was, where was Hillcorp? And I didn't have an answer, and nobody else had an answer, so that just sort of went away. But they were noticeable by their absence, and people that pay attention to this project expected them to be there. So, but other than that, it was a good job. And I would suggest on the summary. Yeah. Bob, to put Tom Erickson's name on there. He came up from Makers.
Oh, thank you.
Right, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary. Bob and Gene, thank you very much.
You bet. Thank you.
Oh, wait a minute. Oh. Wait a minute, please.
Wait a minute, please.
Do we have something we want to talk about? The truck? Trailer?
No, it's taken care of.
Well, maybe, is there a schedule to roll out the new trailer that we should know about?
I believe there is. I don't know it very well. I know Friday you've all received invites for here in Anchorage.
Is it this Friday?
This is Friday the 11th.
Next Friday.
Week from tomorrow. It transitions to FNG Saturday or Sunday.
Yeah, Carson.
Because I couldn't tell you for sure other than off of memory.
Come on up, Dan, if you want.
What time does that start?
The large capacity LNG trailer left visible for ADA board and staff viewing on December 11th. Pardon me. Friday, December 11th, and that'll be at the Crowley facility here in Anchorage, and that'll run from 11 to 2. I'm looking for my paperwork here, and I can't find it quickly.
That's correct.
Yes. Sorry, right. I sent a notice to the board, was it yesterday?
Yeah.
Okay. So you should have all received that. That's an invitation to the board.
Where's their facility?
That is at 201 Arctic Slope Avenue here in Anchorage.
Is that down by Diamond?
Yeah. So that's the official launch in Anchorage, December 11th, and again, invitation to the board and ADA and AEA management. There will also be representatives from the Alaska Sporting Industry Alliance and the Alaska Trucking Association. There will be technical representatives from the truck ownership. Randall Swift, he's president of NTrans International. Brian Yielding, VP of Heil Trailer. And Pat Malara, president of Western Cascade. So they will be on hand for questions and discussions.
As will Dan.
And Dan, yeah. And then in Fairbanks on Monday, December 14th, I've been working with the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce and FEDCO, who have agreed to co-sponsor a great event from 5 to 7 p.m., a chamber after-hours event that will be held at the Pipeline Training Center. And this has not gone out yet to the large invitation list. It has just been finalized earlier today. So this is going to be an opportunity for all of Fairbanks leadership, government officials, elected officials, Chamber, FEDCO. We're going to have a substantial invite list to this for an opportunity to see the trailer and the truck at this training center facility. We will have it parked outside and actually under lights because of the sunlight situation at that time. Have a presentation and materials, and the technical representatives will be inside to discuss. That will be in Fairbanks on the 14th. The following day, on Tuesday the 15th, just working this with Dan now, and we are setting up an opportunity for the truck and trailer to go to North Pole and be in North Pole parked, and we will advertise this in advance to the people of North Pole and encourage them to come and have an opportunity to look at the trailer itself.
Okay, quick question. So Dan, we have the ability to load that trailer of 13,000 gallons at the facility, the LNG facility.
We do, provided the trailer can legally roll at 13,000 gallons. So that's one of the pieces of the test that we're going to be doing, and the indications, assurances from the manufacturer are that we can't put 13,000 gallons in it, still meet Alaska weight restrictions. So that's what we're anticipating doing after the board's viewing on Friday at the Crowley facility. The trailer will be delivered to the Titan facility. At that point, we, as in Fairbanks Natural Gas and Titan, essentially take possession of the trailer for our test. that we're trying to accomplish with having this trailer here. So we're leasing the trailer from Kyle at Western Cascade for $1, no cost to us, so that we can confirm that their trailer can in fact haul 13,000 gallons on Alaska roads and that it operates as anticipated. So we will fill it at Titan over the weekend. We'll bring it to Fairbanks, offload it Monday morning, stage it for the viewing, public viewing Monday night, move it to North Pole Tuesday for the public viewing Tuesday, and then continue on with the testing of the trailer after that.
So you have jump scales? How are you gonna load this thing up and check your axles?
We've got some jump scales at the Titan facility that we can check the axle weights with. We'll probably make contact with, we will make contact with State DOT and let them know we're doing this test, maybe perhaps ask for a little forgiveness if necessary as we work through the... So we'll notify them that on this day we're going to be moving this trailer for the first time with limited knowledge of its weight capacities, and in the event we have any discrepancies, just to get it on the page before we get to the skips. But we'll do the temporary weighing, and then we'll take the... As the test goes on, we'll be taking them using various tractors and various load scenarios of, you know, over a scale and being full. The idea is we'll also probably make a trip with the full trailer to the North Slope. It's just going to go up full and back full, but we'll be able to confirm if there's any technical concerns or driver concerns related to the trailer operation.
So, just reminding me of something I've always been wanting to ask you. Is there a way that you guys can put a set of scales that you load, see, so every trailer that goes out of there is whatever configuration you have to have, because you don't have that now, right?
We don't, and the reason we've avoided it in the past is just really operating a scale in Alaska in the winters with the snow and maintaining the snow removal.
We do it every day.
And all of those problems. That's one problem.
We do it every day.
So that's one reason. The other reason is the way the Titan facility is currently constructed is that we don't have fixed storage. We fill directly into the trailers as we manufacture. So the way that we stage our trailers right now, we'll have 4 to 8 trailers staged in our filling area.
Without the tractor that's pulling it.
Without the tractor that's pulling it under it. And so if we don't pull into a filling lane, fill it quickly, and then pull out, which is where scaling works well. If we have, you know, trailers sitting there, we're filling into one, we switch to the other live while the one's finishing its fill and shut that fill off. So we would require a pretty substantial scaling scenario to be able to do that and know as we're filling what the weights are. So it is possible. It's something that we will look to move forward with as we establish more of what you call a conventional fill rack, where you're pulling in and filling the trailer out of a fixed storage.
Do you have the ability to top off, like get 90%, and then whatever tractor on your way up, quick hit, top it off to whatever that is?
And quick
we
hit
that in gravel all the time.
We don't have a loader that can just dump some gravel in the top of the MD trailer. But
I suppose, you know, quick connect, like a jet fuel balloon.
Not I wouldn't say quick hit, but there is the ability that we can pull it back around the rack, hook up, and top it off if necessary.
Well, that helps the, you know, for every extra time you get on that thing, that drives the cost. So just curious to see what you come up with to get that as. You know, you have it, if the trailer works, it would be nice to make sure that until you get all those trailers, that they were efficiently enough there.
Yeah, and the way that your trailers are designed is they have what's called a 90% tri-cock on them, and that's a valve that's set at the 90% below the level of the trailer, which should be at its maximum weight capacity as well, or pretty close to it. And you open that valve, and once you get liquid coming out of that valve, you know you can do the trailer is full. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the ways we use right now for knowing when our trailers meet the full capacity.
Okay. Thank you.
Carlos, you mentioned one thing. We've had some fairly significant media coverage already. Indeed, it went, the initial story that came out of here, picked up by the Associated Press, and it was picked up nationwide. So they've got a lot of interest in this trailer and this evaluation period.
Yeah, I guess I wanted to thank everybody for the 8:30 briefing this morning. Senator Jean, Bob, and Nick's not here, but it's really informative in a short period of time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks
for the time.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you. All right. Next up is executive session dealing with the IEP, Brookfield Petroleum, Western Operations Centers, and Ambler Mining District. And we'll take a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that the board move to executive session to discuss IEP, Brooks Range Petroleum, Mustang Operations Center, the Ambler Mining District, discussing attorney-client communication.
Second. You opposed? All right. We will go into executive session, and again, our executive sessions are here.